On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. All over America tomorrow, after the bird is carved and the Thanksgiving gravy is socked away, millions of televisions will click on, lock on, to the drama and hoopla and slam dance of NFL football. Tomorrow it will be Cowboys and Broncos and Lions and more, each with 10 big men arrayed around a star quarterback. But at the top of the NFL heap in recent years has been a quarterback who is famous for turning that star power back on the team. Quarterback Tom Brady, the handsome kid from California and Michigan, has taken the New England Patriots to a monster 3 Super Bowl championships and done it with a philosophy that a new biography ties back to Vatican II. Joining me right now in the studio is the great and newly minted Tom Brady biographer, Mr. Charlie Pierce. You may know him from NPR's Only a Game and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's a staff writer for the Boston Globe Sunday magazine. His new book is Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything. Charlie, great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be here.
So here we are. We're reading about a football quarterback, and you open the book quoting Bertolt Brecht and talking about Vatican II. What? What's up? This is a quarterback.
Well, we let it fly a little bit. I've waited my whole life to use the Brecht quote about heroes as an epigram for something. And, it's the famous quote from the play Galileo, where one of Galileo's friends says, "Unhappy is the land that breeds no hero," and Galileo says, "Unhappy is the land that breeds a hero."
It needs a hero, and here's a hero in the NFL, and not just, you are at pains to point out in this book, not just because he's brought home those 3 big Super Bowl rings. What does Tom Brady stand for today in the NFL?
Well, I think his great gift as a public celebrity is to embody stuff without conspicuously standing for it. He absolutely does not want to be the vessel of someone else's notion of virtue. But at the same time, he has developed an almost fundamentalist belief in what it means to be a teammate, and that comes from the fact that he didn't have a silver spoon career the way some quarterbacks did. Most conspicuously, I think Peyton Manning of the Indianapolis Colts. He was in a tough situation at the University of Michigan. He wasn't well recruited. His high school teams weren't very good, and he was a 6th-round draft pick for the New England Patriots at a time when they had a very highly paid quarterback in Drew Bledsoe, who seemed to be there for the rest of his life. But the one thing he did do in all 3 places is to develop a credibility with the one constituency that matters, and that's the other people in the locker room.
The other people in the locker room, you talk about Tom Brady and Catholicism comes straight to the fore here, an instinct for communion, Vatican II.
Yeah.
What's the link, Charlie?
Well, his father, who's also named Tom Brady, was a Mary Knoll seminarian back in the day, and as he told me, left the seminary when he realized that celibacy probably wasn't for him, but is still a very active Catholic, a very active lay Catholic, particularly in the movement since the clergy sexual abuse scandals broke, and is very much infused by what the Vatican II fathers call the Spirit of God, which, it had a lot to do with what Gary Wills says when he says that the people chose not to argue about the council, they chose to live it. And one of the things it established was the ability that authority and credibility and faith rises from the bottom up. It's not imposed from a hierarchy down. And, this is what Tom Brady's father believes in his Catholicism when goes out, and there's a scene in the book where he goes up to a parish in Lawrence and gives a lecture about his own Catholicism as part of a parish fundraiser. It comes up from the bottom. Authority is something that the hierarchy has to earn and it cannot impose. And I think in a very profane context, namely a professional football team, his son sort of has the same thing going for him. He believes that the authority he has as his quarterback is earned by him because it rises from the other team. He doesn't have the authority of a quarterback simply because Bill Belichick gave him the job. He had to earn it among the other people in the locker room first.
So here we've got the profane field of football, and within that, driving at least this quarterback, and we'll look at others as well, but we've got this very singular kind of drive. I mean, everything from Vatican II to bottom-up faith. Charlie, we're going to have listeners who are huge sports fans and others who just, never tune in at all, just to put some of the superlatives out there about this one. First quarterback ever to win 3 Super Bowls, before the age of 27, 28?
27, yeah. He's not yet 30.
Not yet 30. He won 10 consecutive playoffs game, his first 10 between 01 and 05, breaking the record set by the Green Bay great Bart Starr, won 21 straight games in one long
Patriots run an NFL record when he won in 2002 when he led the team to the Super Bowl win. He was the youngest quarterback ever to have won it. Two-time Super Bowl MVP. Where did this kid come from?
Well, he came from San Mateo, California, a suburb outside of San Francisco, via the University of Michigan. There were a couple of folks in his biography that saw the potential in him before anyone else did. One is a guy named Mike Riley, who I'll get to in a minute, who is sort of the Cassandra of Tom Brady's career. And another guy is a guy named Dick Rabine, who was the quarterback coach at the New England Patriots and insisted that they draft him, was Brady's most fervent advocate, and really it passed away a few years ago, but really was the guy who sold him to the Patriots. Now, Mike Riley, I like to tell the Mike Riley story because it gives you an indication of how unscientific football can be. When Tom Brady was a junior and a senior at Sarah High School in San Mateo, the alma mater of, among other people, Barry Bonds, and the late unlamented Pennsylvania gubernatorial candidate Lynn Swann, Mike Riley was an assistant coach and a recruiter at the University of Southern California. And so up goes Mike Riley every week up to San Mateo to watch this guy play. He sees the ability that this guy has to get other people to play around him, comes back to Southern Cal, goes to the head coach, John Robinson, says, we've got to recruit this guy, bangs his fist on the table, bangs his head on the wall. John Robinson says, nah, we got quarterbacks, we don't need him. So off Brady goes to Michigan. Mike Riley gets a job with the San Diego Chargers as their head coach. Out comes Tom Brady from Michigan. Ready to come into the NFL. Mike Riley goes to general manager Bobby Bethard, pounds his fist on the table, pounds his head on the wall, says, we got to draft this guy. You don't know what he has. I know it. Bobby Bethard says, no, we have quarterbacks. We're not going to draft him. So along they go, and a couple of years later, Tom Brady has taken over for Drew Bledsoe in New England, and they're playing a game in San Diego against Mike, or in Foxborough, against Mike Riley's San Diego Chargers. Lo and behold, Tom Brady takes the Patriots down at the end of the game, one of those drives that have become signature for him, wins the game. The San Diego Chargers proceed to lose their next 9 games, and Mike Riley gets fired at the end of the year.
There is no justice.
And as he told me, if he had a cell phone at the middle of the field after the Patriots game, he would have called John Robinson and Bobby Bethard and said, see, this is what I had in mind all along.
Let's poke in to the history here on this guy and try to get a sense of Tom Brady as he was seen coming along. Went to University of Michigan, of course, huge football school. It was a tough and long slog to come out on top as quarterback there, and a lot of drama in that. But there was also a kind of drama we don't associate necessarily with football, college football players, that he was going against the grain from the get-go, kind of here's this big, handsome, strapping guy, but he's the nerd student and somehow won respect from his teammates as a result. You've got a little reading you could do for us here.
Yeah, I'll set it up a little bit. Yeah. There's a guy named Elwood Reed, who's a very talented novelist now, who went to Michigan as a offensive lineman and left the program and, you know, stuck to his writing and is now a terrific novelist and screenwriter. But when he was getting his master's, he had to teach an English composition course. And because he was an athlete, a lot of the coaches sort of funneled their guys into this freshman English composition course. And this is a scene that he told. I called him up just to get an idea of the football atmosphere at Michigan. And he told me this story about one day in his classroom.
Read it, Charlie. We're against the clock here.
So Reed knew that he was looking in his classroom full of knuckleheads. He was looking at a kind of funhouse mirror in time where the years bent and showed him the reflection of the person football had tried to make of him, the person he'd never be. Reed noticed a skinny quarterback right off. He didn't dress the way the other jocks did, a style that could be generously described as workout casual. The quarterback was polite. He was sincere. He read the material that I didn't give a care about in that class when I took it, Reed recalls. What was even more interesting to Reed was the reaction of the other jocks in the class. He'd seen the really heartbreaking ones, the ones who established their own territory through a kind of armored ignorance. Not only did they not do the readings, but they were conspicuously proud that they hadn't, and openly contemptuous of anyone who had. They make fun of you, Reed muses. That's the way they call you from the herd. The quarterback was different. He spoke differently. He even brought his books to class. Reed figured that the knuckleheads would eat him alive.
And, of course, they did not in the end. He ended up being the guy, being the QB there at Michigan. You write, Charlie Pierce, for good and ill, football is a great leveler. In no other sport is the balance between personal achievement and collective accomplishment so exquisitely balanced. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's very, very hard given the nature of football, which is an extraordinarily violent sport, and in which careers are shortened dramatically, almost on a regular basis, to put yourself above your teammates. You're all making the same sacrifices. You all have the same injuries. And while the quarterback has been the central focus of the goodies that come with being a football team ever since ever since Newt Rockne allowed them to pass the ball, he's got to be very, very careful that he becomes the public face of the team without being, for example, the management spokesman in the locker room, or that his commercials don't get in the way of what he has to do every day in the film room. And as I say in the book, in football, it's a very dangerous business to stand out in the wrong way.
And yet Tom Brady gets held up as a guy who stands out in the right way, and we're right back at that kind of commune. Well, there's almost a choir boy piece here, but where does it come from?
Well, it comes from the fact that he will do everything that his teammates will do. That he will, for example, even off the field. There's a long section in the book about the first commercial he did, national commercial that really got him noticed, was last year. He did a commercial for Visa with his offensive linemen, who are the most obscure people on the field.
But there they were, right on the screen.
They
right
were on
him.
The screen in uniform with all the jokes. Tom Brady was the boring straight man in that commercial in a suit. But his linemen were the stars, and his linemen were actually the ones who appeared in the second commercial, arguing about their credit and so forth. And I think the reason he did that was because he wasn't going to do a commercial that contradicted his own image of himself.
Let's go back for a minute to January 9th, 2002, blizzard conditions at the stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts. New England is trailing the Oakland Raiders late in its first round playoff game. Tom Brady engineers a comeback drive 67 yards in 10 straight passing plays that puts his team back in the game and ultimately brings home New England's first ever Super Bowl championship.
Brady's firing all over the place, throws on by Pat, juggles, and it's deflected. It was caught. It was caught by Wiggins.
Knocked in the air and then caught on the rebound at the 15-yard line.
What a great drive.
Brady takes New England right down the field.
The snap to Brady. Looks, stands, starts to run with it. He is down to the five, and he's in. Touchdown, Tom Brady.
That was some drive.
Yeah.
By Tom Brady. I didn't know if he had it in him.
Charlie Pierce, remind us, that was an unbelievable day. The snow was just as thick as you can imagine there, absolutely howling. Here comes this victory, but it comes after tremendous drama between Tom Brady, Drew Bledsoe, the whole dance around who will be the QB.
Yeah, as folks remember, first of all, let's set the global stage. It was the strangest season in the history of the National Football League. That was the season that lost a week to the 9/11 attacks.
Right.
That was the season that was played with this incredible shadow over it. In terms of turning sports events into what were called then suddenly called national security events, so they come. That's the last game they're playing in the old beat up, aluminum seated, Foxborough Stadium, Sullivan Stadium, Schaefer Stadium
before rehab.
Yeah,
yes.
the one of the NFL's preeminent buckets of blood down through the years. It's snowing. It's a beautiful piece of TV, and they come down. They have a controversial call where Brady seems to fumble at a crucial time, but there's some strict constructionist rules that say he didn't really fumble, and we all learned what the tuck rule really was. It had nothing to do with Robin Hood. And then they come down, and he scores that touchdown, and Adam Vinatieri kicks two of the greatest field goals in NFL history, including a 48-yarder through the snow that tied the game. And it was really the first time that you could see how easily this team had come to respond to a guy who hadn't even been the starter at the beginning of the year.
So here we are, just a tremendously dramatic, even kind of super theatrical win right there. Of course, the Patriots go on to win three Super Bowl championships in pretty short order. But the guy there, you describe him moving the chains, is what we also see him sitting at the State of the Union address. You look at his MySpace.com blurb, and he's saying, you know what, my craziest ambition is to become a U.S. senator. You say Tom Brady is all about moving the chains. For the non-fans, describe what you mean by that, and then take us, what's the philosophical point, the personal point you're making?
Well, moving the chains is first down after first down. They're literally measured by chains or along the sidelines, and what they call moving the chains, you get a first down, you move the chains, the chains move to the next 10 yards. And it's sort of a metaphor within the game for constant motion, for keeping your defense off the field, exhausting the other team's defense. In the book, I think it has to do with keeping your life moving, despite the fact that you can wind up being petrified by your own celebrity unless you have an interesting mind. And at the beginning of the book, the only conversation I had with him about the book, he told me, I don't know if I'm old enough for a book like this. And I said, well, if you think you turned off the project, you're crazy, because that's an interesting answer. And I do think he looks at himself and sees a work in progress no matter what he's already accomplished.
But when you asked him or talked to him about the book and he said, I don't think I'm old enough, he was what, only 26, 27?
Yeah, 27. He may well be right. That's the thing. I mean, I was willing to grant him that. But it also showed me a mind that was thinking a couple of steps down the road. It would have been easier for him to say, no, write about my teammates, don't write about me, da-da-da-da-da, you know, put on the modesty front. But instead, he was saying, look, I'm not going to be summed up yet. And I don't think he's going to allow himself to be summed up even when he finally retires. I do think that the one thing about him that I discovered in the course of doing this book is that he is intensely curious about what he's involved in. When he hosted Saturday Night Live.
Which he's done, what, once now.
Lorne Michaels told me.
Singing on Saturday Night Live in his underwear on Saturday Night Live.
The producer, Lorne Michaels, told me that he attended every writer's meeting. He wanted to know why the cameras were blocked a certain way. He wanted to know why does this sketch go first, and why does this joke come before that joke in this sketch, and how you put the thing together. His architecture teacher in high school told me they had to build a house for some sort of project and what have you. And he was, you know, enormously curious in why you would put a bearing wall here and not there, and why things work. And in his day job, that enables him to work the long hours he does in the film room, looking for why defenses react a certain way, and if they don't react a certain way, what can we do, and why does something happen if something else happens. But in all of his other enterprises, including the visit to the State of the Union, he wants to know what's going on around him. He's intensely curious in everything that involves him or that he involves himself in.
A U.S. senator sitting at the State of the Union? What are his politics? Why was he at the State of
the Union? Well, it's odd. I mean, there are a lot of people that presume he's a Republican. There are a lot of people. The SmokingDun.com pointed out that he apparently hadn't voted in his life. Well, he had been registered in California and in Ann Arbor in Michigan. You know, the assumption is that he's a Republican because he did go to the State of the Union address for President Bush. Marty Meehan, the congressman from north of Boston, told me, however, that in a small room, Tom Brady's ability to make the person he's talking to feel like the only person in the room is rivaled only by that of Bill Clinton. And as you know, that's like comparing a teenage pianist to Mozart, because Clinton was the best who ever lived at that.
Charlie, we've got a lot of listeners who want to join the conversation. We're talking about one great quarterback and maybe others as well. Where do you place Tom Brady among the greats? Look at Peyton Manning right now. Look back to his hero, Joe Montana. What does it take to make this kind of quarterback? And is this a new kind? We're at 800-423-8255 with Charlie Pierce. His new biography of Brady is Moving the Chains. Fred is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Hey, one of the main things about Tom Brady, I'm 34 years old. I grew up in New England, followed the Patriots for quite some time. I'm under the opinion that I think right now we're in a kind of a cultural dark ages and we're in a spiritual dark ages. And Tom Brady, to me, is kind of my Renaissance guy. He's the guy that kind of says, you know, I'm not afraid to just, I don't have to be, you know, a big mouth. I don't have to be show off as an athlete. You can succeed by just hard work ethic. You can succeed by being genuine and by being articulate. And I think he's just a voice for continuing education. And he's a great voice, not only for kids, but he's a great voice for guys like me just pursuing a professional career. And you can say, you know, you don't have to be what everybody would expect you to be. You can just be yourself, and you can absolutely be successful in what you do. And one of the things I overheard Coach Belichick talking about one time is how Tom Brady, 3 years in a row, there's a particular parking space that the whole team fights for. It's a preferred parking space. And Tom Brady has won that award of that preferred parking space 3 years in a row because he's always the first one to show up for camp and for practice.
Right. You show up, do the homework, come and get the space. But, Fred, let me ask you, do you expect this personality in a quarterback? I mean, does it seem like the most natural thing or a rarity there?
Well, I think it's kind of a natural thing, kind of like a pitcher is to baseball. They are sort of the in-the-classroom manager of the team, and they are expected to take on a certain role of leadership. But not all players do that. And I think as today commercialism has expanded, and I think, obviously the fiscal agenda behind sports, the monetary rewards have expanded, I think you kind of see that less and less. I think the Manning brothers are, you know, a standout. But back in the days, you know, Joe Montana, I mean, those were gifts. And I think Tom Brady today is certainly a gift because, you know, that there could be so many that are not.
Right there on display. Fred, thanks for your call. Charlie, Joe Montana, the great hero of this quarterback. Why?
Well, first of all, because they grew up, it was the home team. They tailgated at the San Francisco 49ers game every week. But I think it was also his ability to perform in a team context at the highest level for the biggest stakes. As Tom says in the book, you know, the games he remembers are the ones that are 35-34. He doesn't remember the blowouts. He remembers the one where you go back and forth and you finally win at the end of the game. I thought Fred had an interesting point at the top there, and it gives you an indication of a little bit of what I was doing with the Brecht epigram at the beginning of the book.
Mm-hmm.
People find themselves investing all sorts of things in this guy, which frankly kind of embarrasses him a little bit because it does make him out to be some sort of you know moral exemplar, which is a way of as we said earlier in the thing about Elwood Reed, of standing out in the wrong way in football. And I think just as if you went to Larry Bird and asked him about being the greatest white player who ever lived, he would run away from you.
Mm.
If you go to Tom Brady and bring him this stuff, he will run away from that interview. He doesn't want any part of that.
And yet, in a way, the country's looking to try to get to the other side of celebrity.
And I think part of it is what the country was looking for in the fall of 2001 when he came along. I think they were looking for, you know, team spirit, for lack of a better word, and a sense of unity and a sense that some virtues were still strong enough to get us through what we were going through. I think it's very significant in the public image of Tom Brady that he came along in the season that he did.
Let's take a call from Peter in Atlanta. Peter, do we have you there, my friend?
Yes, you do. I'm curious, you just made the analogy to Joe Montana and Bill Walsh was his coach. I'm curious, in the same way that Montana might not have been as successful without having the mad genius of Walsh, what you think Belichick's impact on Brady is, and whether Brady would have been as great and had such great results early on in his career without having the benefit of somebody like Bill Belichick at the helm.
Well, I don't think he would have had the success he's had without Bill Belichick putting the team around him that he did. This is something that comes up in a lot of coaches down through a lot of quarterbacks and their coaches down through the years. Bart Starr was a great quarterback, but he never got credit because Vince Lombardi was such a towering figure. Mm. Joe Montana and Bill Walsh, as this guy pointed out, and Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. I can tell you that the one thing that Bill Belichick did for Tom Brady was finally put him in a system that Brady believed was as close to pure meritocracy as you could get. At Michigan, he was not the starting quarterback, largely for reasons that had nothing to do with how well he played, and it drove him crazy. I mean, the idea that playing well wasn't enough is not something that computes with this guy.
Remind us of the story in Michigan with Lloyd Carr, the coach there.
At the end, he had brought in a young quarterback named Drew Henson, who was sort of a local two-sport hero. Michigan had outbid had managed to beat out the New York Yankees, among other people. And the feeling was that Henson had been made promises that Carr felt obligated to keep, despite the fact that Brady was the consensus choice among the other players. So they had this incredible two-year span where nobody was really happy. Brady was tremendously unhappy, but managed to keep it to himself, didn't blow up the team, and wound up eventually becoming the starting quarterback he should have been for 2 years, leading them to a big win over Alabama in the Orange Bowl and saying all the right things afterwards. That, when he got to New England and realized that he had a chance to move up the depth chart and indeed had a chance to beat out Drew Bledsoe eventually, and it didn't matter how much money the Patriots were paying Bledsoe, I think that's where the bond with Bill Belichick first formed, that he was finally in the meritocracy where how well he played was the only thing that mattered.
Money followed, 6 years, $60 million, but there's the player on the field setting this kind of, is it unique? You tell us, character among quarterbacks. We're at 800-423-8255. Peter in Atlanta, thanks for calling. Jim is calling from Lake Placid, New York. Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. Just had a quick question about the playoff records of Tom Brady and Bart Starr.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure if your gentleman writer was referring to perhaps that Bart Starr won 9 playoff games in a row, and that's what my question really is.
Comparing Bart Starr and Tom Brady.
Well, I'm totaling up Bart. Yeah, obviously, they didn't play as many playoff games as they did in Bart Starr's early career. There was no Super Bowl, for example, and there were no playoffs. You won the Western Conference and you played the Eastern Conference for the NFL Championship. So they had less chance of that. And of course, Bart Starr lost in 1960 to the Eagles. So I'm sort of totaling them up in my head now, and I'm getting two over the Giants, two over the Cowboys is 4. two Super Bowls is six. I'm not coming up with nine.
I think Brady's 10 is still breaks the record set by Bart Starr.
Right.
But compare them as football players.
They were drafted at relatively the same point in the draft, although there were fewer rounds when Bart Starr was drafted. They came out of big programs where they weren't necessarily the biggest star in the program. They were overshadowed by coaches. They never got the credit. Bart Starr, my friend Alan Barra, the sports historian, will go to his grave arguing that Bart Starr was a better quarterback than John Unitas, but will never get the credit because John Unitas never played for such an overwhelming cultural figure as Vince Lombardi. And I think that it's less of a chance now with Tom Brady because I think he has stepped up to the point where he is, I think, equal. I mean, people will say, well, he might not have prospered for any other coach than Bill Belichick, but his public profile is as high as Belichick's is now. Belichick's, you know, monumental shadow will not obscure him the way Lombardi's did Star.
Jim, thanks for calling in from Lake Placid. Let's go to Atiyah calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Atiyah, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for this great show. I was calling because I think Tom Brady has also done a lot in terms of drawing women to football in general, and it's not because of his good looks.
Oh, no?
Well, it doesn't hurt, but for me, it's not because of that. You know, as a mother of a little boy and as the wife of, you know, a lifelong Patriots fan and football fan, what draws me to the game is there's something about him and the way he conducts himself, and it's not necessarily that I think he's sort of moral, that makes me want him, you know, to win. He, you know, I see him as, you know, this good guy, and I want him to win. And it makes me really enjoy this sport that I can't, in all honesty, understand.
But just having him there, what do you say, Charlie? It's not the looks, Atiyah says.
Well,
it's the moral standing.
We will accept that as the truth for the moment. And he does have, I mean, as we explained a little bit earlier, he does have the ability to get other people to invest themselves in him at a distance and close up. We heard that from Marty Meehan, but we also heard he does have the ability to get people to involve themselves with him. His family comes from a family of huggers. He's a big he'll hug and kiss his old coaches. Bob Kraft, in my book, without I think really knowing what the term means, calls him a metrosexual. But he does have
a moral message in his play itself.
Yeah, I think in a way that he is conspicuously generous with how he passes the ball to as many receivers as he can. He embodies this kind of meritocracy that we talked about Bill Belichick developing earlier.
And one among many, which may have a kind of appeal these days when celebrity is so big, when stardom is so big, to deliberately
it's counter-programming himself, almost.
Right, counter-programming, and you can hear right there in Atiyah people responding to it, wanting their kids to watch this. Charlie Pierce is with us. His new book is Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything. Among the things he has pursued, those rings that come with a Super Bowl championship. He's talked about which one's most important to him.
He had been in Michigan for 25 years or so. He's got so many Big Ten rings. I mean, he doesn't have enough fingers for all the rings he's got. And he says, you know what? I'll never forget. He says, you know what, Tom? You know what my favorite ring is? And I said, which one's that? And he goes, the next one. And that's what I think, the next one.
The next one, Tom Brady says. Charlie Pierce, remind us the coach he's talking about there who wanted the next one. It's at Michigan, I think.
That must be the late Bo Schembechler, who passed away this week, I believe. I would have to think. I don't know that Lloyd Carr has a lot of rings.
but Tom Brady looking for the next one. Steve's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, guys. My question is, what if Tom Brady's career has already peaked with his Super Bowl victory a couple of years ago? What if he goes on to play another 10 years and is just a very competent but non-championship quarterback? He's very competitive. How do you think he would handle that kind of thing?
Every place I go, people ask me that. And I think there are a couple of, I think my answer is kind of odd. I think he can handle being a championship, and I think he could handle being on a really bad team that he could make better. I don't think he would handle 8-8 year after year after year, the enforced mediocrity of how the NFL rigs its teams for its parity. I don't think he could handle that. I think the idea of making the playoffs but not really doing anything or almost making the playoffs year after year, I think that would drive him bats. But I think, you know, he can handle a good team, and I think he could handle a really bad one that he could see him making something out of. But, the you know, years of enforced mediocrity, I don't see him handling. I also don't see it happening. But
Charlie, what about, I mean, the Patriots have not had such a great year this year. Let's look at the Peyton Manning rivalry in particular. I mean, we've seen Tom Brady explode on the sidelines when things were not going well against Peyton Manning. Compare these two quarterbacks and their relationship.
Well, oddly enough, I've done a lot of work in magazines with the Manning family, all of whom I adore. At bottom, you've got two really talented quarterbacks, the two best quarterbacks of their time, I believe. And there aren't many people who can play the position. There are 30 teams in the NFL. They all have three quarterbacks, which is 90 guys. And of those 90, maybe 65 of them can actually play the position in the NFL. So leave that aside, but they have become this sort of battle of archetypes. Peyton Manning is the guy with all the statistics and all the commercials who took a lot of money and hasn't won anything yet. Tom Brady is the guy who did a few commercials, won a lot of titles, and left a little bit of money on the table for the team to use to get things better around him. Now, this all comes to represent stuff to partisans of both men. I think it's a little bit silly. I think for one thing, as somebody points out in the book, it really denigrates the achievements of the Patriots defense. But I think if you're dealing with dueling archetypes, those are your two, Peyton Manning and Tom Brady. Plus, they play each other every year.
Yes, they do. And when the one loses, the other is happy and vice versa. Jim's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, folks. I just wanted to make the comment. I thought it was pretty funny that the show was on. I'm a huge Tom Brady fan. Everybody is. But I've been telling all my family and friends to remember that I told them first that Tom Brady was going to run for president someday. And I think I've read somewhere that he's interested in politics, and I just think it's fascinating that I've never seen a guy that I can think of anyway that's as popular with every demographic, old people, young people, fans, non-fans, men, women. He's got something special, and if he ever turns into politics, who knows?
Charlie, how about it?
Well, he turns political consultants into children. I mean, they just start babbling.
He says right at MySpace that his dream is to be a U.S. senator.
His craziest dream.
Okay, so maybe can you see that really happening?
He will not do. Yeah, I mean, I could see that. I think he's going to be a public person after he retires. I don't think he's going to go into the broadcast booth. I don't think he's going to be an assistant coach somewhere. I think I can see him doing business. I can see him doing some sort of foundation work. I can see him doing the political thing.
So if that's the case, we've just got a minute and a half here. What's the opposition research going to dig up? I mean, the golden boy, but what's the downside to Tom
Well,
Brady?
They moved his sister out here because he was enjoying his success from his original Super Bowl a little bit too much. And I'm sure there's enough there that, I mean, plus Oppo researchers just tend to make stuff up anyway. But I'll tell you what, they're going to have to dig. They're going to have a hard time of it. And you know what? I have a feeling it's not going to matter.
Where's the Tom Brady love life stand these days?
Near as I can tell, he's still dating the lovely and talented Bridget Moynihan, movie star of East Longmeadow, Massachusetts.
And wedding bells?
I have no idea.
And the future of, you say he doesn't want to just go down slow. Does he play the end of his football career differently from other big quarterbacks somehow?
I think he will be more active in putting the team together around him now. He was very upset when Dion Branch was allowed to leave for more money. And he was quite vocal about it, which he hadn't been in the past. And I think he will take more and more of a role in constructing the team around him as the years go by. And I think he's earned it.
Charlie Pierce, it's a great read on Tom Brady. We get Bertolt Brecht and Vatican II and NFL football all in one package. Only you, maybe, Charlie, could bring that to us. Moving the Chains, Tom Brady in the Pursuit of Everything is the biography. Charlie Pierce, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great, Tom. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.